This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, July 1st. Here comes summer in the biggest way. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes, Eve Zuckoff, and Sam Houghton. We'll speak with George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Casey Myers of the Provincetown Independent and check in with Jason Graziadei of N Magazine and Nantucket Current. And we'll speak with CAI's Patrick Flannery. And now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. We're going to start off, actually, with last week. Last Friday, just after this program ended, the news broke that the Supreme Court had issued a decision that effectively struck down Roe versus Wade, which had guaranteed a woman's right to access to an abortion. The decision had been expected ever since a draft of it was leaked some weeks back, but the final arrival of the decision, which took away women's rights to make choices about their bodies, sparked a lot of outcry across the region. We're going to spend some time talking about the local response here in the first segment of the program. We are joined by CAI reporters Jeanette Barnes. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
Also with us, CAI's Eve Zuckoff. Hi, Eve.
Hey, Steve.
And sitting here in the studio with me, Sam Houghton. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Jeanette, let's start with you. This was a history-making decision for sure, and one that has drawn a strong response on both sides. You reported on the first-day reaction locally. What was happening that day in terms of public protests or celebrations?
Well, the local demonstrations we saw in the days right after the decision, at least on, and especially the first day, were mainly in favor of abortion rights. I know we're going to be talking to Eve as well, maybe about some of the Cape events. But in New Bedford, they gathered on the very first day, and they went to a big intersection. It's at County and Union Streets. I'm told that it was a women's group that put out the call for that protest. And I spoke by phone to Marlene Pollack, who is a longtime organizer with the Coalition for Social Justice and very active in New Bedford. She was there. I could hear kind of the cars honking in support in the background as they were driving by. She said about 20 people had gathered by the early afternoon, and they were expecting that number to build a little bit later in the afternoon. One of Pollack's comments, as someone who spends a lot of time herself thinking about poverty and justice, was the idea that she believes Republicans don't want to provide enough public money for childcare that women need, and that more of it, of course, as a result of this decision. That was her comment. I also talked with the vice president of the New Bedford NAACP, Renee Ledbetter. She was not at the rally, but she said the decision takes away women's autonomy over their bodies. She also asked a question that's been on many people's minds. What's next, right? She said, will it be affirmative action or civil rights in some way that the Supreme Court, goes after, if you will, from her point of view next? So their comments, I think, were representative of a lot of the concerns out there in the community.
Now, you also spoke with two doctors in our area that day. How did they say this decision will affect women in states where abortion is banned?
Yes. Dr. Dale Weldon, who lives on the Cape, and she's an OBGYN in Boston, she said this decision is creating a geographic disparity in healthcare. And she said that really deepens the disadvantage that some people already face in getting healthcare. And of course, part of what she's referring to there is the idea that wealthy women from states where abortion is banned, in many cases, have the opportunity to travel to other states, such as Massachusetts, to obtain an abortion, whereas other women without the same means may not be able to do that if they don't have the money, they don't have the control over them off from work, all of those complexities. I spoke to another doctor, Marcus Gordon, who is the medical director at Four Women Health Services in Attleboro. This was interesting because even though it's in Attleboro, this is one of the closest, if not the closest, clinic to our area that performs abortion. Dr. Gordon said, history shows women will continue to have abortions even when it's illegal. So his comment there was, the question is, will they have access to safe abortions?
What's the response been from people who support the Supreme Court decision?
Well, certainly people locally who support the decision have been speaking up on social media. Also, Massachusetts Citizens for Life responded with a number of comments. The president of that group, Myrna Maloney Flynn, she said this is a hard-won victory that their movement has been working toward for the almost 50 years since Roe v. Wade. Her group also said that they feel the anti-abortion movement has its work cut out for it in Massachusetts, which expanded access actually to abortion in 2020.
Eve Zuckoff, let me bring you in here. You went to an abortion rights rally on the Cape. What can you tell us about that scene there?
Yeah, so I went to the Hyannis Airport Rotary where people were holding signs and getting honks in support and honks in opposition to kind of what they were saying. Among the demonstrators, there was just a lot of anger, a lot of fear, like Jeanette said, a lot of kind of what's next? Which of our rights will be on the chopping block here? Same-sex marriage, more access to contraception. But people also shared stories, really personal stories. One woman told me that she had been there to support a loved one, several loved ones through the decision to abort because they were already struggling to take care of children they had. Another woman I spoke to right at the end of the rally, she broke down in sobs, true sobs, explaining to me that her mother had to get an abortion after having three prior children because of life-threatening health problems that the baby would have had. And so her mother made the choice to be there for the children who she already was taking care of. So it was just a lot of high emotions at this rally.
And that wasn't the only abortion rights rally locally.
No. You know, we've heard there were events in New Bedford, Vineyard Haven. We're also told an estimated 300 people gathered in Falmouth. I saw some photos from that. And it actually seemed to be a much more diverse group racially than what was in Hyannis. But I think similarly, really high emotion at that event, too.
Sam Houghton, we also saw reaction on the Supreme Court decision at the state level. Going back to Friday, what were some of the initial reactions from our elected officials at the state level?
Yeah, the big one was an executive decision by Governor Baker, really moments after the Dobbs decision. And his order basically affirmed Massachusetts, you know, as a safe, legal place for abortion care. There's a protection in the order for anyone that might be traveling from out of state for services. You might have a state like, say, Kentucky that's outlawed abortions. They might try to pursue criminal charges against, you know, a resident traveling to Massachusetts for these healthcare services. And there's a protection against that in this order. It also prohibits any agencies, you know, law enforcement officials in the state's executive department, like the state police. It stops them from assisting another state's investigation into a person, you know, trying to get reproductive health care services in Massachusetts. Baker's order also prevents healthcare providers, Massachusetts from losing their licenses because of out-of-state charges. And the governor fielded questions for the first time on Monday, and he said he's talked with law enforcement and healthcare providers about boosting security at clinics around the state. And he also said that this interesting here could be a boost to businesses coming to Massachusetts that might move here because of, you know, the access to safe, legal abortions. And we should say in the governor's race, we had a very stark contrast in reactions. Maura Healey, you know, the sole Democrat in the race now, she actually broke down in an interview on our sister station, live interview on GBH. She said the Supreme Court decision, you know, was horrible, a setback for women's rights. And then the GOP front runner for Governor Jeff Deal, on the other side, issued a statement saying that he and his wife support the ruling. But I think the big one here was this executive order from Baker.
Well, state House lawmakers also passed a bill that, similar to Baker's executive order, would further protect reproductive health care providers here in Massachusetts. Explain a little bit what is in this bill.
Yeah, it's basically an expansion of what Baker did. So Baker is the executive branch, so agencies he has under his authority. The House bill would spread to basically the whole state. So this would forbid, you know, licensing boards from disciplining someone, getting in or assisting in abortion or even gender affirming care that was put in the bill. Police would be barred, you know, any police would be barred from helping federal or state law enforcement or even a private citizen from another state trying to seek charges. There was a mention of so-called bounty style provisions in states like Texas. That would allow Texans to seek charges against another resident traveling out of state for abortion care. Also, this bill would boost access to emergency contraception. And the House voted this through pretty overwhelmingly on Wednesday. Very overwhelmingly, we should say. There were a few objections, some mostly Republicans, but some Democrats did vote against it as well. Now, this will go to the Senate for a vote soon. Likely soon. We've already heard from state senators showing a lot of support for it, so it likely won't take long for it to pass.
I want to take this back to the local level before we let it go. Eve, let me bring you back in here. When you were at these demonstrations last week, what did you notice about the makeup of the crowd? What can you tell us about the people who came out?
Yeah, well, first of all, just in terms of ages, there were everything from little kids to grandmas and everything in between. Older women said they couldn't believe the next generation would have to have this fight again. One woman told me the very first political action event she ever went to was 43 years ago, and it was on Cape Cod and how to, you know, motivate pro-choice voters is how she described it to me. And she was like, I cannot believe I am standing here again doing the same thing I did 43 years ago. There were also young women. One woman said she goes to college in Florida, and she said she was scared for her friends in states like Florida, where the right, not just Florida we're talking about here, but scared for friends who might not be able to travel to a different state because they didn't have the funds to do it. If they were in a situation where they needed the procedure. I will say, I'm saying women a lot. That's the thing. There were very, very, very few men, at least in Hyannis. And it looks like there were some more in Falmouth from what I could tell from a bunch of pictures that people sent in to us. But I think that there was, I talked to a couple men about it and said, what do you think about this? And they said, you know, this is disappointing. There are lots of men in this country who have benefited knowingly or unknowingly from not having to be a parent when they weren't ready, or, you know, from helping their partner through a pregnancy and abortion in a situation where having a child would have killed them because of medical needs. And they said, you know, there should be more here, and men need to be talking to each other. Actually, a few different men told me that we need to be having conversations amongst ourselves to motivate each other to take this on as a human rights issue and not a women's issue.
Eve, I want to switch gears here and talk a little bit about some environmental news. This week, you reported that cyanobacteria blooms are back in local ponds. And in fact, two Cape Cod ponds have been closed because the blooms could be toxic. What can you tell us about where the problem is and what's happening?
Right. So as of today, the two ponds that are closed to swimming for both humans and animals, dogs, we're thinking mostly there, are Long Pond in Barnstable and Mashpee Wakeby Pond on the Mashpee Sandwich Line. But there are a bunch more ponds experiencing kind of smaller blooms where there aren't yet indications that the blooms themselves are toxic. And that's the thing, actually, this blue-green pea soup-like algae known as cyanobacteria is usually totally harmless. It grows naturally, but when it has heat, when it has nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus, it just multiplies, it dominates, and it starts producing toxins. And when we are exposed to those toxins, we can experience anything from skin irritation to fevers to, in really high concentrations, major organ damage. There's a real risk. So if you see one of those signs out there, you know, it really is for your own good to avoid swimming.
Well, this is the holiday weekend. Lots of people want to go swimming. It's
pretty tough
timing here. Yeah.
Brutal timing. Of course, lots of people plan their vacations to the Cape around the 4th of July weekend. And this weekend is the Mashpee Wampanoag 101st annual powwow. So there are lots of Wampanoag people who are having a bit of a homecoming this weekend. The Mashpee Wakeby Pond is, first of all, the biggest pond on Cape Cod, and it holds a lot of both ceremonial and just kind of like emotional, social significance to the tribe. So it is terrible, terrible timing. Yeah.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. Eve, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll continue speaking with CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Sam Houghton, and we'll hear from George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. As we head into the summer, a Cape Cod resident's thoughts naturally turn toward the beaches, toward swimming, and toward sharks. A shark was caught on video eating a seal off Race Point in Provincetown. CAI's Jeanette Barnes, you talked with shark researchers on the Cape who held their annual update this week in Chatham. Tell us about what you heard.
Yes. Well, it was good to get an update on how this research is going. Greg Scomel, who is a shark biologist with the state, works closely with the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy and their staff scientist, Megan Winton. So they gave a little presentation about their work studying shark behavior in near shore areas. And the idea, of course, is to use that information to improve public safety in the water. Scomel said the sharks are spending about 47% of their time in shallow water where humans are, 15 feet or less. And the sharks are looking to feed on seals. That's why they're here. The researchers are logging more and more shark detections each year, but they said that doesn't necessarily mean the population of sharks off the Cape is going up every year, because there are more tagged sharks every year and more buoys. And so that automatically increases the number of detections. Of course, at longer term, yes, there are more sharks here returning to feed on the resurgent seal population. And several years ago, four years ago, we saw off Wellfleet, there was a fatal shark bite. And so that has certainly tuned people into this idea that shark encounters could increase. And that's part of what's fueling all of this research.
Well, tell us a little bit more about this new this year with it.
Good question. Yes. So Scomel said they're going to try some larger buoys for the real-time shark detectors. So their project only has 5 real-time acoustic detectors, even though there are many, 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 many of these buoys up and down the Massachusetts shore, something like 80 for his project, and then about 200 for various organizations like the aquarium and so forth that have some of their own detectors. They all detect the same tags and they all share data, which is pretty cool. But for Scomel's work, only 5 of them provide live data, which goes to their app. But some of the reasons for that are the cost of those live units. And they also get destroyed in the weather conditions out there. So he got funding for 2 larger buoys to try to make that better, try to make them withstand the weather. In addition to that, Megan Winton talked about the drone study they're doing. The idea is to fly drones over the beaches and find out whether the drones can do as good a job sighting sharks visually as a buoy can do with detection. Because drones are a great tool, but they could be very limited if the water is cloudy or there's sun glare and things like that. So when the researchers know there's a shark there because of there's an acoustic detection, then they're looking at, can a drone see it reliably in various kinds of conditions?
Sam Houghton, let's take a look at the state of the pandemic a bit here. Cases have been dropping since a surge in cases in May and June. That is good news, but there's concern on the vineyard as we head into the summer. What are health officials saying?
Yeah, the hospital on the island had been hosting these kind of regular news briefings for a lot of the pandemic, but that hasn't been happening for the last few months until this week. And the hospital administrators wanted to get the word out that COVID is still, you know, a threat on the vineyard. And the biggest takeaway, I thought, they've also been having staffing problems because so many staffers have gotten COVID. They had 70 cases among workers over the last 2 months. And that's put a real strain on services. So far, they haven't had to make any cuts to two services. Those 70 cases, we should say, you know, weren't all at once, but they are concerned. And the wording they kind of use is it's a fragile situation. They have been going over like reassignment plans if things do get worse, and they could bring in workers from Mass General Brigham, but they haven't gotten to that point yet. And I think, you know, one of the reasons for getting the word out on this, they've had people coming to the emergency room after, you know, testing positive for COVID. And that can be kind of a headache. You know, they say don't come to the emergency room unless you're really sick with COVID.
Mm. The hospital also mentioned new COVID variants or subvariants. What's the concern there?
Yeah, these are called BA4, BA5. They're new subvariants of Omicron. The hospital's CEO, Denise Schapisi, says these are expected to make up 90% of cases in Massachusetts just in a couple of weeks. So the dominant strains, and it's coinciding, you know, with an increase in activity on the island with the 4th of July and the height of the summer. It doesn't seem like these are virulent or as bad as kind of the early strains. You know, hospitalizations haven't gone up on the Vineyard. But they can, you know, she was saying evade natural immunity and vaccines. And she basically said, you know, take the safety precautions. We all, you know, want to enjoy summertime and don't want to spend a week or so in quarantine. You know, wear the mask if you're comfortable wearing one. That was her wording. Use the instant test. Stay home when you're not feeling well. So, you know, in a way, nothing we don't really know already. Mm-hmm. But, you know, friendly reminder as we're going into the busy season.
Well, we're going into the 4th of July weekend right now. It's here, and we could have crowds not seen since pre-pandemic times. Let's talk about what that means for local folks here, especially for local police departments. You spoke with one police chief. It's a busy time for them, obviously, and it comes at a time when all these departments are typically struggling with staffing. What did you find talking to the chief?
Yeah, I mean, I think the 4th of July for police departments really across the Cape, it's all hands on deck. And I spoke with Chief Peter Wack, the Sandwich Police Department, and he basically said, you know, if you're an officer on Cape Cod, you know you don't get a day off this weekend. And so in Sandwich, they're actually fully staffed. And I don't know if that's rare, but a lot of, you know, departments are struggling. Peter Wack gave a lot of credit to a county police training academy for helping him get to fully staffed. But, you know, he did say departments across the Cape are struggling. And a big reason for that, he's heard, and we talk about this all the time on the show, housing. Mm. You know, officers are having a difficult time affording housing here. But Sandwich, you know, for this weekend, they try to get to those areas that might have a lot of activity this weekend. They have a parade and fireworks display on Saturday. We did ask about beaches. We know some towns have, you know, geared up for the 4th after getting reports of a lot of trash from beach parties and an occasional fight. Wack said, you know, they don't have big issues with beaches in Sandwich. There's a lot of private beaches, actually, where they do get more kind of complaints of trespassing than anything. But they're focused on, you know, kind of the bigger areas of town.
What are some of the strategies that some of these departments are using as they're confronting all these crowds and they are understaffed?
Yeah, we know in Falmouth, they have been closing beach parking lots overnight. This is, you know, stopping folks from gathering, causing problems overnight, things like, you know, trash collection. They just don't have, you know, the manpower to make the rounds every night to every beach. Harwich is also closing down their beaches overnight. That's an effort to keep crowds down there. But, you know, I think an interesting issue, something, you know, to pay close attention to as we head into this weekend. I did, Steve, before I wanted to go give a shout out, a few activities to think about if folks do want to brave the traffic this weekend. As Eve was saying, Mashpee Powwow, that's the next 3 days. We had a story out of Chatham that they're expecting some record-breaking crowds for their parade this weekend. Kind of a funny note, their theme for their parade, Chatham, as salty as it gets. and also Falmouth Fireworks are back. It's the 40th anniversary this year. They've been on hold the last 2 years because of COVID, and those are Monday nights. So big weekend here.
CAI's Sam Houghton. Thanks, Sam.
Thanks, Steve.
And CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Steve.
Martha's Vineyard is losing teachers. That's the headline in the Martha's Vineyard Times. It's not difficult to understand what the words mean, but what it means for the island is a big question. George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
George, at the heart of this is housing and the lack of it.
Yeah, you know, we've written a lot about housing, of course. There's been a push to have a housing bank on the island, and that's in process before the legislature. And we've really tried to put a face with this issue. We did a section a bit ago, and as we've told this story over and over again, you know, it doesn't get any better. And this year, it just seems particularly worse. Abigail Rosen did this story. She talked to a number of teachers, I must say. We had teachers talking to her who didn't want to be named, but we had enough going on the record to share their stories. And it's so important, I think, to be able to put a face with this issue. She talked to several teachers in this story, and we're not talking about just young people, although there is a young teacher who grew up on the island, wants to come back to the island and teach here, and she got a job here, worked here for a year. But how long can you sustain living with family again? You know, she wants a place of her own for her and her child and her partner. And we have an older teacher, 26-year veteran teacher, who's had stable housing for years in the rental market, but suddenly the owner and the landlord passes away, and the house is put on the market, and the rental is gone. And there aren't more rentals right now. There just aren't. They're not available, and if they are, they're swept up in moments. Housers swept up in moments above asking price is still happening here. So this is an ongoing issue. And I think one of the best things that Abigail pointed out in this story is these teachers, because of their salaries, and they're not exorbitant salaries, but they're professional salaries, they're not eligible for the programs that the state has. So we need this housing bank to help people in this situation, not just teachers. We've had stories in the past about nurses and even doctors. We've had stories about firefighters and EMTs and police officers. So important to have some of them, of course, living here. You know, you can have some commuters. I'm a commuter. But you do need people who live here who are in the workforce as well. So it's a big, big issue.
It's a big issue. It's a great article by Abigail Rosen. It really, as you say, puts faces and names and personal stories to the issue.
As I always like to say to reporters, you want to show readers. You don't want to just tell them. And this story does a great job of showing.
And let me turn to the fourth, the weekend. A lot going on the vineyard. And there will be a first of sorts. This is a neat story. It really has a bigger optic to it. It has to do with women firefighters. Tell us what's happening.
Yeah, this is by Unki Sanu. And he got to meet some of the island's women firefighters. And this year, they're going to be highlighted in the parade because there's a number of them. The average is 4% as of 2020 for firefighting forces to have women firefighters. On the island, we have about 12% island-wide. Pretty good. And all of these women told him that it's because these fire departments are inviting to them. They're willing to train with them. They're willing to work with them. And it's a great little story. And it's great that they're going to highlight them. They're going to march in the parade together. They're going to be with this antique fire engine in the Edgartown Parade. And so we'll all get a chance to applaud, you know, these first responders who are willing to take on what has to be one of the toughest jobs out there. You know, being a first responder, my hat goes off to them. Some of the things that they see on a daily basis.
Hey, that's all we have time for, but if folks are looking for a rundowns of what's happening this weekend, holiday weekend, they should definitely check out the Martha's Vineyard Times. You've got nice stuff, nice coverage of what's happening. That's George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thanks, George.
Thanks so much, Steve. Take care and have a good weekend.
Chatham has been wrestling with water issues after two water wells had to be closed following the discovery of PFAS contamination. Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle and sometimes our weekend host here on CAI joins us with an update. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, Steve. How's it going?
Bring us up to speed. One of the wells here is now back online. Is that right?
Yeah, so good news on that front. One of the two town water wells on Training Field Road is back online. That's thanks to a temporary system that's been put in place to remediate the PFAS in that well. The second well remains offline, although in the event of an emergency, say a fire or some sort of event of that nature, water from that well can be mixed with the one that just became online just to give the town the water it needs to address those issues. But for now, this temporary system has one well back in service, and they're hoping that a more permanent system, a long-term solution to addressing the PFAS, will be in place by the fall that will get that second Training Field Road well up and running.
Well, one of the issues then becomes the quantity of water that's available and restrictions on water use in the town.
Yeah, I mean, this is a step forward. Obviously, anything in the realm of PFAS remediation is good news, but conservation is still very much the word in Chatham, and that's something officials are really stressing to residents and visitors. They've tightened their outdoor irrigation restrictions to allow for the practice Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays between 3 and 7 a.m. and 6 and 10 p.m. Outdoor hand watering is allowed at all times. But, you know, as we all know, we're in a drought. You know, rainfall has not exactly been plentiful in our region. So, water conservation is a big issue, and the town is really just asking for the cooperation of everybody to follow these restrictions just to keep the town's water supply sort of on the level.
I want to ask you about a story you reported out of Orleans. Town of Orleans is looking for new potential properties as it eyes a list of building projects that it would like to undertake.
Yeah, it's a busy time in Orleans. Among the many things they're looking at, they're actively in the process of trying to site a new fire station. There's been talk of a new library. There's a task force that's looking at a new community center. And then, of course, there's the issue of housing. We all know that's the issue that really never goes away, the need for affordable and workforce housing. So there's a lot of issues, but the land really isn't there. And it's sort of risen to the level where the select board have kind of openly said, hey, if you're in town and you're thinking of selling your property, give a thought to giving us a call and maybe making a deal with the town. They just really want to find the land wherever they can find it to free up the space to accommodate some of these projects that are really needed in town. So that's really just where they're at. And they really essentially just want to be more assertive in terms of seeking out property.
And what are they hearing so far? Does it seem like it's coming up with new properties for them?
I think it's a very early start to the conversation. I don't know how far they've gotten into it. I will say in the search for fire station sites, there were requests for proposals, and they have sort of put it out there to residents. Just like I said, you know, would you be interested in working with the town on a deal for your land to site the station? And those they did not get any responses, as I recall. So that was sort of like the first, you know, dipping the toe in the water in the issue. But it might take some work, but this was really just kind of a kickoff conversation, just stating the town's need to kind of find land really in any way they can.
That's Ryan Bray speaking to us from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
You are listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll be speaking to Casey Myers of the Provincetown Independent. Stay with us. This is the Local News Roundup on the Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. We're going to speak to Jason Grazia Day on Nantucket right now. The question, should artificial flowers outside store be regulated as signage? Don't laugh. It's a hot question at the moment on Nantucket. Jason joins us to explain. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
What's the background here that this has become such a contentious issue for the island?
Yeah, as you mentioned, you know, sort of a first world problem, certainly. But on Nantucket, as you know, the entire island is an historic district, and we have our historic district commission, which regulates the architectural appropriateness of all development on the island. And we even have a sign advisory committee, which looks at signs around the island and things of that sort. And right now, they're taking a look at these faux floral installations that have been popping up on storefronts around the island. And the question is, are these flowers actually signs? Should they be considered signs? And if so, do they need to go through the same sort of regulatory process for approval and, you know, constructive criticism for appropriateness as a sign? So the florist who's been putting these up, you know, argues that, they are not signs, they are flowers, they're temporary. But people feel very strongly that, you know, some people feel very strongly that these are inappropriate and sort of don't go with, you know, the historic nature of the island, of the downtown, of Main Street. And there's others who feel, you know, these bring a vibrancy and are beautiful and make them feel good and are very much should be part of sprucing up the downtown and making it. So this debate has been playing out at the Sign Advisory Committee over the last month at several meetings. There's been about 30 letters from the public that have flooded into the Planning and Land Use Department about it, and the Sign Advisory Committee is going to be taking it up once again next week for further discussion.
Well, your article even dives down far enough to undertake what the definition of a sign is on Nantucket, according to the Advisory Committee, and kind of trying to figure out whether these flowers, these big flower displays, and these are artificial, again, flower displays, meet the definition of a sign, right? A public sign.
Exactly, yeah. So these are sort of silk-made flower installations that, you know, some are on Main Street, different places around town, some very prominent businesses. And you're right, the Sign Advisory Committee has actually a definition of what a sign is, which is a device used to advertise, inform, attract the attention of the public, which they, some would argue, saying that that is exactly what these floral installations do. So they should be considered as a sign and go through the same regulatory process as you would when you're opening a business and you're applying for permits and you have to go through the Sign Advisory Committee to make sure that your sign is in keeping with the downtown historic district and the aesthetic of the island. So they're looking at all that right now. Some strong feelings. And the primary company, Hofstra and Company, that has been putting these up around the island is very much involved in this debate and feels very strongly that, you know, given the nature of her business, you know, any sort of added regulatory, you know, sort of bureaucracy that she has to go through to do this could very well put her out of business and could be a real detriment to what she does as a florist and working with these businesses around town.
Mm. And a little bit of a philosophical question, because if they're natural flowers, there isn't even an issue here.
Right. And so people have said, well, you know, does your window boxes, when you fill them with flowers, that attracts attention to your store? Should that be considered a sign? Of course not. No one would say that. So we're getting it. You're exactly right into the sort of philosophical. What is a sign? What is not a sign? And is it art? You know, is beauty in the eye of the beholder? Or is this something that we really need to be bringing government into or not?
All right, and let me turn to affordable housing, which is such an issue for the island and the region. Nantucket is adding to its property inventory for affordable housing. Tell us what's happening.
Yeah, so the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, which has been granted millions of dollars in taxpayer funds over the last 3 or 4 years at town meetings, signed a purchase and sale agreement on Wednesday for to acquire a 3/4 acre property at 14 Somerset Road, which is in the Mid-Island area, for $1.79 million. And this is the latest in a string of acquisitions by the Affordable Housing Trust over the past 2 years that has been adding to the town's sort of real estate portfolio of properties dedicated to affordable housing. And as you said, such a big issue for Nantucket, for the Cape. individuals, families, businesses are struggling with this now, you know, and we're seeing people leave the island, you know, critical workers, whether they're from the hospital, the schools, police and fire departments, you know, making very, very difficult decisions about whether to stay on the island. And it really comes down to housing. So this has been a focus for the town, for voters, to really put some resources behind this. And so now we're starting to see these acquisitions. And the idea is really to do this in a scattered site approach where there's properties, not all sort of concentrated in one area, but trying to do it in various areas around the island to spread out these acquisitions using taxpayer money to acquire either, you know, property to be developed or existing homes to be used to rent affordably or potentially land to develop for home ownership opportunities.
It's Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Overdose death rates are on the rise in the state and on the Cape. Casey Myers of the Provincetown Independent joins us with this story. Hi, Casey.
Hello, Steve. How you doing?
I am doing well. Casey, your reporter Emma Magic does a great job laying out this story. Explain what some of the factors are contributing to this rise in deaths that we're seeing.
Yeah, so the problem, unfortunately, has been we've been aware of it for a while. Experts have been aware of it for a while. The deaths keep going up despite lots of investment on the Department of Public Health side in solutions, but it seems like the drug dealers, the drug supply, just keeps getting ahead of any kind of catch up to treatment. So what is going on right now is that the drugs out there, it's mostly fentanyl, which is of course a synthetic opioid that's way stronger than even heroin, and that has been killing people for years, and now it's even kind of worse than that, in that there's all kinds of other unpredictable, toxic, highly contaminated, and basically unknown and surprising substances in the drug supply. So, I mean, people who are using drugs don't even know what they're getting, and one of the Access Hope, the founder of Access Hope, Kim Powers, she's a harm reduction specialist who goes around in her car and distributes fentanyl strips and clean syringes and other, and she kind of watches people from a distance while they're using to make sure they're okay. She said that what is really needed right now is not just fentanyl test strips, but basically the kind of machine that cops use to test drugs just so users can know what is in it. One of the ingredients that seems to be popping up, it's an additive that is a depressant. It's a horse tranquilizer, and that is a tranquilizer will kill you from an overdose, and it doesn't respond to naloxone, or which is commonly known as Narcan, which will reverse people who are overdosing from opioids. But there's all kinds of things that just don't respond in the same way. And so that is a gigantic issue. And also another thing that Ruth Pote told us, she's an incredible expert who lives in Greenfield and is a doctor and MD who's done a lot with treating people with opioid disorder. And she was saying that the other issue is kids are ordering what they think is an oxycodone or an Oxycontin online from these dark websites, and really they're getting a pill that contains fentanyl. I think that's been covered here on the Cape in Falmouth, I believe it happened. That's the issue. And so now it's how do you catch up with this problem? So Kim Powers was saying, well, one thing that would be great would be to have this kit that where you could test for any kind of drugs that's in your supply, and if there were harm reduction sites around the Cape, that is a good place where drug users could access this machine.
It's a tremendous challenge right now, and in some ways, with all the attention that was taken up by the pandemic and dealing with COVID and the pandemic, this particular issue has kind of been allowed to fester to the side. Now we're seeing that it really has gotten worse in those last couple of years.
I know. Isn't it strange that I know so many things did get pushed to the side with COVID. But it is amazing how far this one was pushed to the side. It was just kind of maybe the burnout of social service industries just in their normal lives. Just COVID just pushed it over the edge. And it's just people just became so isolated in their using and treatment just seemed to really fall away. Yeah, it's really scary. So the question is now, what do you do? And some of the other solutions out there seem to be mobile treatment. Mobile treatment is really up and coming. And could there be a mobile methadone van on Cape Cod? That would be huge. That's what Ruth Poté is advocating for, because especially where I am on the Outer Cape, it's, there's nothing. You can't get methadone unless you go daily to Yarmouth, which is just so difficult. And Suboxone is another opioid, and it's another treatment for opioid disorder. Casey, you can get it at Outer Cape Health.
Yeah, we're going to have to leave it there, Casey. But it's tremendously complicated story. And your article in the Provincetown Independent from Emma Magic really lays it out nicely with some of the treatment options, too, that people are reaching towards. It's Casey Myers of the Provincetown Independent. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Many public schools saw their last day of the school year this week, but the work of public schools never stops, especially for superintendents. And a surprising number of local districts are getting a new start. Now CAI's Patrick Flannery joins us with this story and more. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, Steve.
Tell us, how many districts are welcoming in a new superintendent and why now?
The number is six districts welcoming superintendents beginning today. That's Barnstable, Martha's Vineyard, Nauset Regional, Provincetown, Sandwich, and Wareham. So it's a lot. I'm not aware of a time when the region saw this much of a shakeup on the same day. And it comes after a school year when we saw a major transition with learning. Governor Baker took remote learning off the table, as we know, earlier this year, which current and incoming superintendents agreed was necessary. They'll tell you there's really no comparison between learning on Zoom versus learning in the classroom when it comes to a young person's development. And most of the outgoing superintendents in our region chose to retire early or just not seek a new contract. And in one case, Steve, a superintendent moved to another regional district.
Mm. Patrick, I'm conscious of the time here because you also have a great story I want to touch on here, which is about Cape Cod having a new beach. And it's not really a new beach, of course, but it's a beach that's been open to the public for the first time. In fact, I think the ribbon cutting was last night.
Yeah, just in time for July 4th weekend. First Light Beach is now officially open as we speak to residents of Brewster. Last night, the town held its grand opening off Main Street on what was once the Cape Cod Sea Camps. And this comes almost to exactly 100 years after the Sea Camps opened. And of course, during the pandemic, the owners decided to close. And Brewster voters approved the town to purchase the land last fall. And the tennis courts were recently taken down to make way for the beach parking lot there.
Tell us a little bit about the name of this beach. First Light Beach, it's called.
Yeah, it was given its name in May to honor the Wampanoag. And that name translates to People of the First Light. And it was chosen by the select board from hundreds of suggestions from residents as part of a contest back in April. And it was picked to honor the Wampanoag tribe after consulting with leaders to ensure that the name was culturally sensitive and historically accurate. The board said this was an opportunity to recognize the history of the tribe, whose history dates back thousands of years.
And they put this together very quickly. They just got the property not long ago.
Yeah, a lot's happened between October and today. The voters approved the purchase of the land in October. And it was only a month ago that Public Works began construction on beach access and paving the parking lot, which accommodates 50 cars. It is open every day through Labor Day. Anyone can walk there, Steve, but to park there, you do need a town resident permit.
That is CAI's Patrick Flannery. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
And that is our program for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes, Eve Zukoff, and Sam Houghton. We spoke with George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent, Jason Grazia Day at N Magazine and Nantucket Current, and of course CAI's Patrick Flannery there. Big thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. He's the voice in my ear explaining and reassuring throughout the program. Now I just need him there through the rest of the day. Thanks, Dan. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.